You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
So, hello, Connor Friedersdorf. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Glenn?
I'm doing excellent. Excellently. This is Glenn Lowry at The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv and also at Brown University, talking with Connor Friedersdorf of The Atlantic Monthly Magazine, and welcoming him to The Glenn Show. So, Connor, I asked you to have this conversation because you've been of late reporting on a colloquy that you've been having with some Donald Trump supporters. And I think it's a very interesting and perhaps important set of observations that are coming out of that. And I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to share that with our viewers.
Yeah, so I'm always trying to figure out why are people voting for the person that they're voting for. And of course, you get a lot of idiosyncratic explanations, but sometimes some of them recur again and again. And I've had two rounds with Trump supporters where I've written at The Atlantic, hey, if you're supporting Donald Trump, I don't get it. Explain this to me. Why? What is it that you see in the guy? And so I published a roundup, I think it was last summer. And is that too long ago? It was some months ago anyway. And I printed about 30 responses from Donald Trump supporters. And one thing that came up again and again is that they felt that voting for him was their own way of sticking it to political correctness. There's this backlash to political correctness. And everybody I'm talking about in this group used that term. Some people fleshed it out in different ways than others. And it's something that has come up again and again in talking to voters who are supporting Trump. Then I started corresponding with this young man who lives in the Bay Area and who requested anonymity, the San Francisco Bay Area, requested anonymity because he felt that he couldn't be out supporting Donald Trump in his job, felt that it would have career repercussions, and basically laid out the fullest explanation I've seen from anyone with this Trump is a backlash to political correctness kind of motivation of what exactly it was that he was talking about. And the way that he sketched it out had a few different components. One was feeling stifled, unable to set forth his views on social media. He said he didn't post on Facebook at all about any of what he termed his right-wing views because he felt that it would lose him friends and future career opportunities. He talked about saying something at his job about liking the WWE wrestler Hulk Hogan and not realizing that Hulk Hogan had recently made some controversial statement. I think it might have been a homophobic statement. I'm not sure, but he didn't even know about the statement, and his coworker looked at him askance as if he must be homophobic because he's quoting or he's saying he likes Hulk Hogan, and he thought this was a PC excess. And then he just talked about free speech concerns generally and his feeling that if Hillary won, he felt that we would keep going down what he called this road of political correctness. But if Donald Trump won, it would be evidence that a majority of Americans don't buy into this nonsense, and he would personally feel more comfortable speaking about his less politically correct views. And I kind of pressed him and I said, well, you know, what right-wing views are you talking about? I wasn't sure if I was dealing with someone who is on what they're calling the alt-right now, a kind of like white supremacist. And
yeah.
It turned out that no, he was not anything close to that. His views were nothing that's particularly nothing you couldn't get 40% of the American people behind, say. And so it certainly included things that I disagreed about. He wanted a temporary ban on immigration from Muslim countries because he was worried about Syrian refugees coming here and perpetrating acts of terrorism. And he wanted to shut down illegal immigration in a way that is consistent with what, you know, the sort of rightward half of the Republican Party has sought for a long time. He's on the restriction side of the Republican divide. But he didn't express any views that you haven't heard from presidential candidates other than Donald Trump say. And so it was striking that he felt as stifled as he did. I was a little bit surprised by that. And also, you know, I would press him and I would say, well, what about all these terrible things, in my view, terrible things about Donald Trump? And he would acknowledge a lot of them and say, well, yeah, you know, I can't defend this. And I'm not going to try to. I disagree with him here. He said that he would prefer in a perfect world a Gary Johnson candidacy, Gary Johnson being the libertarian candidate and a former New Mexico governor who was pretty moderate on social views, pretty liberal, in fact, on a lot of social views. And but he felt in a Trump versus Hillary race, he could stick it to political correctness, and that if Hillary won, he would feel even less comfortable than he does now with what he feels to be a kind of leftward PC shift in American discourse. So that's basically his take.
Well, I was just going to remark, because I read this exchange between you and this particular correspondent, that he acquitted himself fairly well. I mean, this is not a person of low intelligence or not informed about the issues or unable to articulate his views. I thought this was not a crazy person. This was, respectably reflective observer of the American scene. But what do you make of this? Are you persuaded this is a small and not especially representative sampling of American opinion or millennial American opinion. But do you think there's something to this idea that some of the Trump support and some of the immunity that Trump seems to enjoy from being damaged by the outrageous things that he has said and done derives from the fact that the outrage itself is attractive to some people because it flies in the face of constraints that they themselves have chafed against?
Yeah, you know, as you alluded to, I want to be cautious because I obviously don't have polling data before me, and we all live in bubbles and interact with the people we interact with, and it's sometimes hard to know about the vast majority out there that we haven't spoken to personally. So it could be that this is a minor phenomenon of that explains Trump's support rather than a major phenomenon. But still, I am convinced that it's playing at least some role, I would say, a significant role, if not an overwhelming role, in his support for a couple of reasons. One reason is that it's part of a larger trend that I've noticed on the right going back to 2008 when Sarah Palin was nominated and gave her speech at the Republican convention and her subsequent campaign along with John McCain. And what Palin tapped into, and I've looked into the polling data on this quite a bit, was a sort of resentment, a feeling that among a lot of people, that among a lot of Sarah Palin supporters, well, we're not going to support her because we think that she's the most qualified person in the world, but she really drives the left crazy. And she drives them crazy in a way that just attracts her to us. People would say, you know, she sticks it to the media, she sticks it to the cultural elites and their coastal enclaves. And what I took away from Palin was basically just that this can be a powerful motivator in politics. The idea of I'm not going to support this person because I love them. I'm going to support them because of how they make my enemies feel, how they make the guys on the – how they twist the knife for the guys on the other side in a way that reassures me in my cultural orientation, that is feels like a fighter for me in the culture war, these kinds of motivations. And I hear the same kinds of things from just about every Trump supporter that I talk to. I also do a lot of reporting on college campuses, and I see on college campuses a pretty quiet but powerful backlash against political correctness. I don't know if you're familiar with there's a writer for Breitbart.com who goes around the country doing this tour that he calls, what is it? There's some epithet in the title. It's he calls it the Dangerous Faggot Tour, and he is openly gay, and it's just a sort of intentional provocation. From the name, you can surmise everything that you need to about what happens when this guy gets invited by the Campus Republican Club to go on some campus, and he goes, and invariably it's like he saw how Ann Coulter succeeded, and he's doing a campus tour version of this where he goes around and gives these speeches, right? And so when he's on college campuses, invariably leftist activist students take the bait and come and shout at him and try and shout him down. And it's exactly what fuels him. You know, if no one came to protest, then the spectacle would die down and he'd cease to give speeches. But the interesting thing, to our point, is that when he's being shouted down, so he's in a room where a bunch of people have come to see him, some curious, some supportive, some anti. And when the people who are against him start to shout him down, the people who are for him start chanting Trump, Trump, Trump.
Oh, wow.
As if, like, this is the thing that's going to really tweak the other side and drive them really crazy. We're here for a spectacle, and this is what's really going to amp up the spectacle. And since publishing this email from the 22-year-old, I've got, you know, four or five responses to my email box that are, this is exactly what I'm thinking. Can I have this person's email? Because, of course, I feel so much like this person articulated what I haven't been able to. I've gotten, you know, a dozen more emails that were, yeah, I think this guy has a lot of it right. I'm voting for Trump and I'm thinking some of the same things. I saw a young person write on the site Medium, which is kind of a blogging platform, another piece that I sent you the link to and that we can put up, that was essentially the same thing. I'm voting for Trump because I'm tired of people telling me that these views that I think are correct and that are not motivated by bigotry are bigoted, and that I'm a terrible person for holding these views. And so it's I would say that, again, while I want to look at all the exit poll data and the polling data that that's going to come out over the course of the general election, if Trump is the nominee, as he seems certain to be, I've seen enough of it anecdotally to think that it's a phenomenon worth talking about and exploring it. And I think there is this backlash against political correctness in the country that the polling data definitely bears out. You see something like, I think it was a Pew poll. I'm not sure, I can find it after the fact, but it was something like 60% of Americans think that political correctness is a significant problem, and majorities of every racial group and men and women. When I saw that poll, I thought, well, no wonder this is so controversial on college campuses. A majority of every demographic in the general population is worried about this and is thinking about it enough to tell a mainstream polling organization, yeah, we think that this is a significant problem. One more caveat before we go on, and that's just that when people say this, that they're worried about political correctness, we have a sense that we know what they're talking about. And at the same time, it's a really hard phenomenon to pin down. It's a really, if you try and define political correctness, you find that it's really difficult to do, and that people are, when they say it, they may all think they're talking about the same thing. I think there are shades of differences in what they're talking about, and that teasing the phenomenon apart more would maybe prevent people on both sides of this fight from talking past one another sometimes.
Well, why don't we try to do that a little bit? I once wrote an essay about political correctness. It's been 20 years now since it was published, where the view that I took was that if voicing a certain opinion led most observers to draw some negative inference about your character and say you opposed affirmative action and people imputed a racial motive to you, a racist motive to you for opposing affirmative action, that would lead most people to withhold the expression of their opinion for wanting to avoid having that, shameful and detrimental view of them embraced by other people. And they might think something, but they wouldn't say it. They might not think affirmative action was right. They might think it was unfair, but in a dinner party conversation or sitting around in the lunchroom or something like that, they would hold their view. And my idea was that this might be a stable situation in which many people would feel stifled in this way if, as a matter of fact, the only people who were willing to actually express the view were the ones who knew that this shaming would be forthcoming but didn't care enough about that to be deterred from speaking. And it's likely that, in fact, people who did have anti-Black motivations would be the ones who'd be least harmed, or maybe even they'd feel some benefit from having others react to them in this way. So that's a kind of mutually supporting set of interests. I mean, why isn't that a reasonable definition? I don't know if it's operational, if we can say in a given factual circumstance, aha, political correctness is afoot here, but it does seem to capture, you know, much of what it is and we think we're talking about. No?
I definitely think that the shaming aspect is key to the backlash, if not to political correctness as a whole phenomenon. It's at least key to what's causing people to be upset, and the shaming is one of the aspects of it that I'm most interested in, because it raises a really thorny question, and that's this: that we have things that are that there are stigmas against in the United States, and if you were doing a cost-benefit analysis, you'd certainly say that the benefits of the stigma are significant in some cases. It's significant that we've gone from a country with slavery and Jim Crow to a country where using the N-word is stigmatized, and where the racial animus that using the N-word is standing in for is stigmatized. And I think that the vast majority of people, including the ones who are upset about excessive political correctness, are perfectly fine with that social norm. They're perfectly fine with a stigma against, child molestation. They're perfectly fine with a stigma against certain categories of things that just aren't argued about in mainstream publications, aren't discussed in polite company, the kinds of things where if you met a new friend and you were playing racquetball with him and suddenly you found out that he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, you'd say, oh, wait a minute, I'm not going to continue this relationship. And so then on the other hand, you have this guy who goes to work and says something about Hulk Hogan, and he has views about immigration that some people find wrongheaded. And so on one hand, it seems like you're stigmatizing a much broader range of things now. You're stigmatizing beliefs that a majority of the population have in some cases. Is that so are we looking to the inherent offensiveness or harm that something causes? Are we looking to the percentage of the population that holds these views? Someone could perfectly plausibly argue that, deporting even a quarter of the 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States causes much more harm, say, than using a racial slur. You're presumably sending armed agents of the state in to break up families and send some back to dangerous countries. And so how do we decide what is deserving of stigma? It's tricky because on one hand, the idea that nothing should be stigmatized intuitively doesn't seem quite right. The idea that stigma is a useful thing politically with views that a majority of the country holds also doesn't seem quite right. And so how do we decide? How do we reconcile these conflicting intuitions that we have about the right way to engage in politics in this very diverse, pluralistic country? And I don't have any good answer for you.
I think you were talking about the N-word or the Ku Klux Klan or the use of the F-A-G-G-O-T word casually in reference to gay people, slurs, insults, expressions of hatred. That's one thing. I think if we're talking about arguable differences of views about policy, for example, thinking that if you don't have a border under control, you don't have a country.
Right.
It's an essential precondition of national sovereignty to be able to regulate the composition of the polity. And you're then condemned and morally shamed for holding that view, something that a person might agree or disagree with, but it's certainly arguable and is not obviously dispositive relative to somebody's basic moral commitment. It doesn't show a person to be evil or bad for holding that view. And then a ton of bricks fall on you. How could you say something like that? What kind of person are you? That's quite another. I remember when some Black Lives Matter activists shut down the Bay Bridge connecting Berkeley to San Francisco in the midst of a protest while I was on leave at Stanford. And I don't know how many tens of thousands of people must have been inconvenienced by that, but it's the Bay Bridge and there's heavy traffic there, and it's a bad crossing even on the best of days. And I thought, what are some of those people thinking when they finally get home at 8 p.m. tonight, having gotten off work at 4:30, about the activists and their goals? And then I listened to some of the activists who were interviewed and who were very self-righteous, I guess is the word that I would want to use here. I mean, absolutely, it was within my purview. I mean, we're fighting for justice. I mean, and then there was some opinion to the effect of, well, from people who were inconvenienced, we should be willing to tolerate the inconvenience because, after all, this is a symbolic expression of something that's, they're fighting against something that's evil. But it struck me as not at all obvious that the morally correct position in response to those events was to support the people who shut down the bridge. And yet I can imagine that in many social circles, criticizing that move would have been, would have left one in bad standing with one's fellows. So
yeah, I like and agree with your insight that it's the idea that we ought to be stigmatizing hatefulness rather than any particular view judged by the harm it might cause strikes me as wise and is basically the practice I try to follow myself. If I were to try to spread that norm, I think that the place that it would get hung up in the wider society, it would get hung up. People would say, well, there's an organization that tries to normalize the idea that it's okay for adults to have sex with children. The
North American Man-Boy Love Association, NAMBLA.
Yeah. That's a fringe example of are they coming from a place of hatefulness? Well, no. Do we want to stigmatize them? Well, our intuition is probably yes. I think if that's the example I have to live with for the stigmatized hate, I can live with it. I don't think that actually the effectiveness of our shared near consensus against pedophilia relies on stigmatizing the people who are openly advocating for it. I think that you can very easily and one point I want to make, I think, that I tried to – I'm very much against Donald Trump, more than I've ever been against any other political candidate in my lifetime. And I think that comes across in the conversation that I have with the 22-year-old that I corresponded with. I did not pull any punches when I was arguing with him. I said, here's why I think you're extremely wrong. Here's all the catastrophic things that I think will happen. Here are the misjudgments that I think you're making. Nevertheless, he felt and I feel that I was very respectful to him and his views and that we had a civil exchange. And I heard from a lot of the Trump supporters that I heard from after the fact said, I was really appreciative of how respectful you were to listening to his views. And they were more open to arguing with me into hearing my perspective because of their perception, and I think a correct perception, that I was fair to him insofar as I gave him a hearing. I listened to what he had to say. I responded to it. I didn't stigmatize him or try and say you're a bad person. I said, I think your position is extremely wrongheaded, you know? And I think what gets lost sometimes for the people who want to use stigma, the people on college campuses who want to stigmatize any transgress, anything that they dub racist, sexist, cissexist, you know, any word that they want to throw out, they act as if to stigmatize something is the only way to show the full measure of one's opposition to it. And I think that that's a trend, you know, more broadly in American society, that to oppose something is to express outrage or express stigma or attack the person holding the view. And that it would be really useful if we got back to a place where we're attacking views as strenuously as you want. I'm all for going after people and ideas that are wrongheaded, but it just doesn't require going after the people. And in fact, I often think that it is just self-indulgence, that in fact it's harming the cause. In a lot of cases, it's just solidifying people in their beliefs. And I've seen no evidence that it persuades people to embrace more right-thinking opinions.
Okay. So I wonder if it's useful to distinguish between the cause and effect backlash type analysis that you're engaging in. If people are intolerant of fringe or different opinion, that can induce in the people holding those opinions of feelings of resentment, make them susceptible to supporting candidates like Donald Trump, undermine the ability to actually reach some kind of compromise over important issues. Distinguish between that on the one hand and this kind of argument about free speech that goes on, which is, you know, I'm thinking about shouting down or protesting the presence of a speaker on campus who's about to offer some views on behalf of an opinion that's not popular. The same self-righteousness, the same haughty contempt for other view because you're just so certain that you've got it right, the same sort of moral certitude that leads to, he's the police commissioner from New York City and we know they have a racist policy of stop and frisk. He mustn't be permitted to speak at Brown University, which for some of us felt like whatever you think about stop and frisk, it's a much, much, much greater offense to prevent somebody from speaking. I'm trying to relate the political correctness issue with other patterns of behavior that, the fate of the Christakises at Yale over the Halloween costume snafu. I gather now that they both stepped down from any position in campus residential life there. Yeah. We could give many other examples.
One thing that's going on in the example of shutting down Ray Kelly from speaking or the Christakises, a lot of times the student activists who are doing this, they've done a kind of rhetorical move, an intellectual move, where they basically try to conflate the thing that they're trying to shut down with violence. They try to erase the boundaries between speech and violence by saying that, well, this is a different category of speech. This is hate speech. That's inherently violent. Basically erasing the line between these things. You saw it with in San Jose last night or yesterday afternoon, it might have been, there was a Trump rally at the convention center, and there were Trump supporters who were coming out of the convention center and protesters who were throwing eggs at them. In one case, hit a guy on the side of the head and bloodied his ear. And you've seen the same behavior inside Trump rallies. You've seen dissenters in Trump rallies. You know, one got sucker punched and Donald Trump said, well, I'm going to pay the legal bills of this guy who sucker punched a guy as he was leaving the arena. So you've seen this violence on both sides. I don't want to quite draw an equivalence because, you know, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, and every other presidential candidate in my memory has very clearly never endorsed violence. And in fact, when it's happened among their supporters, they said, stop this.
Yeah.
I don't support this. Trump is the only candidate who has explicitly encouraged violence among his supporters on a few different occasions. The New York Times has a pretty good video of some of those occasions. But nevertheless, among among the kind of fervent pro-Trump ground troops, you could call them, and the anti-Trump, you see these clashes. In Costa Mesa, where I grew up, there was a Trump rally where the anti-Trump protesters were throwing rocks at police cars and you know, trying to chase after a car that came out of the Trump rally before the police kind of sealed off the parking lot. And there's a quote in the LA Times where it was something to the effect of one of the protesters being quoted saying, well, Trump is a racist. He deserves what he gets. Right. And I remember thinking two things. You know, one, there's this conflation of, well, you hold ideas that we find odious. That's the same as or rises to a level where we are justified in responding with violence. The other is what Trump got in that case was publicity that only solidified his supporters.
Right.
When there's a bunch of people, as at both of these rallies, who are waving Mexican flags as they you know, perpetrate violent acts against Trump supporters, it's like there's someone at a white supremacist site somewhere who's rubbing his hands together waiting for the donations to come in, and someone in the Trump campaign office who's like, this is exactly what we want.
But by the way, if I may just observe, the act itself is despicable. That is, quite apart from its consequences. I'm saying the act of throwing a rock at a police car, throwing an egg at somebody, that's a violent act. Now, Trump, as you point out, has his own deeds and words to answer for, and nobody's defending what he said from the podium inside of some of these rallies where he has seemed to instigate or foment or certainly condone. But there's a lot of violence against the Trump supporters that I don't see being reported in the press, and maybe I'm just reading in the wrong places, to nearly the same degree. And it seems to me to be necessary to denounce that violence, quite apart from the fact that it also serves to, you know, marshal Trump support.
Yeah, it's you know, I my piece up today was I felt compelled to write denouncing it, and it's definitely, you know, it's definitely covered by the press. The journalists who were there were tweeting about it, and were the Washington Post had a I don't know if it was a front page story because we read everything online now, but it was a major news story with embedded video of the different violent acts. Cool. I wonder though if the commentariat is going to cover it, and I suspect that they will cover it much less than if Trump's, you know, if Trump supporters had gone to a Hillary rally and started beating people up, I think you'd see a lot more columns from the opinion side of the newspaper business and the magazine business denouncing it. So I do think there's a little bit of a double standard there.
Yeah. What did you think of Hillary Clinton's speech last night? Did you hear it?
I didn't hear it. No, I was busy writing about this Trump.
Okay.
So I'll have to go back and watch it.
Guys got to go to work. No, she comes very tough on Trump as being unfit to be commander in chief. It was billed as a foreign policy speech. She didn't talk so much about her own policy. She talked mainly about the fact that Trump was a dangerous and dangerously incoherent person and temperamentally unsuited to have the nuclear codes. And it seemed to signal a strategy, a line of attack to which he would obviously be vulnerable, and we'll have to see how effective it is. But it's nasty business. I mean, and you know, maybe there's just no other way around it. I mean, you know, it's a scare tactic. I mean, you know, you think about that famous advertisement back during the Johnson-Goldwater campaign, 1964. same kind of thing. Nuclear coach. You want to put, if he tweets at 2 o'clock in the morning when somebody pisses him off, what do you think he's going to do when he's got his hands on the entire American arsenal and somebody pisses him off? You know, it's one thing to do a real estate deal and to have it blow up in your face. It's another thing to have the world blow up in your face. Not a quote, but that was, you know, pretty much the, this is a guy who will, if he ever gets any real responsibilities, destroy the world with probability 0.1 or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, go ahead.
You know, running against Barry Goldwater, he had views on just about every policy imaginable that were very clearly set out. He wrote a book about him. You could very easily engage in a substantive campaign against Goldwater. I don't know that you can against Trump. His views are so quickly changing. He'll abandon a position seemingly – I mean, I'm sure he would abandon it under political pressure. He'll abandon it just because he happens to say something different in a different day. A journalist asks him a different question and something else comes out of his mouth. And his supporters don't seem to be bothered by this. They haven't been bothered by it throughout the campaign. It's not his positions that they're attracted to. It's his posture. It's their idea of who he's loyal to. But I really – to me, if there was ever a campaign where it's legitimate to make someone's temperament a subject of attack, it's this one. It's a large part of the reason for his support, and it's also it's certainly the thing that keeps me up at night, thinking about well, how would he actually be as a president? Josh Barrow wrote a good piece about this. I think it was a Business Insider, where he basically described Trump as a candidate with the biggest long tail risks.
Yeah, I saw it.
His argument was essentially that Hillary Clinton is you basically know what you're going to get with her. There's no reason to think that she would be any different in this sense from a Mitt Romney or a Barack Obama or whoever else. And with Trump, Barrow said, you know, there's a small chance that Trump would be a president that would do things that he thought were ultimately good. There's also a bigger chance than with anyone else that he would do something that Barrow would regard as really catastrophic. And when Trump has openly aired ideas like killing the families of terrorists, like defaulting on the sovereign debt of the United States with his history of bankruptcy, especially, the way that Barrow put it is, if he won't rule these things out, why should I? And it's hard for me to know how to react, both as a voter and as someone who doesn't want to stoke paranoia and hyperbole. When this guy is saying these things, I write him off as a reality TV show blowhard, or do I take him seriously? Or I don't know. I don't know where the right point to come down is.
I respect the fact that it is unnerving and there is a great deal of uncertainty. I mean, some of this stuff, can he, as president, elect to default on the national debt unilaterally? I don't even know that the president has the power to do that. I don't know. I mean, I would have to look into exactly how the financial thing works. You know, some of what he's saying is said for effect, but it does leave you uncertain. I guess I'm sitting here wondering, you know, I used to write a lot about incarceration, and give speeches, and one of my lines was, if you don't think that a person is a part of the general social body like the rest of us, it becomes possible to do just about anything with them. Throw them on a dung heap of debris, give them 25 years to life for the most minor offenses, shoot them down like a dog in the street and without consequence. And I'm thinking by analogy that, you know, if the country is threatened with the possibility of someone who is going to lead America to fascism or is going to start a nuclear war because he got out of bed on the wrong side this morning, or whatever, it becomes possible to conceive of doing just about anything with such a person. And I almost shudder to say it out loud. I mean,
I understand.
See what I'm getting at?
Yeah, and to me,
and the consequences of that could be very long-lasting and extremely gravely negative for the country as a whole.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's not something to talk about lightly, particularly because we've gone through periods in American history where there were multiple presidential candidates who were threatened, some who were killed, and to me, the clear imperative for anyone who even had that thought crossed in mind is we're trying to prevent what we're trying to prevent by stopping Trump electorally. Those of us who think that he would be a disaster for the country is precisely the slide into the kind of anarchy that would be realized if violence were to befall him. In other words, that's already crossing the Rubicon into the place where we're using force rather than the power of the ballot box. And using force in that way can only empower the most irresponsible, the most sociopathic, the most impulsive among us. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. And man, talk about unleashing the forces on Trump's side, the ugliest forces on Trump's side, indeed, and empowering them in ways that would be terrifying in themselves. Any way you look at it, I'm confident in an argument with someone who's thinking about violence that I could, you can never count on persuading someone, but that I would have the better of the argument. I do, it's something I worried about with Barack Obama. But by the time that he leaves office, God willing, the Secret Service should get a huge bonus for having the first black president and very controversial among the farthest right wing, someone who a lot of people treated as illegitimate from the beginning. And now they've got a tremendously hard job with just a standard issue candidate. I'm sure it's not easy to handle security for a Hillary Clinton. I'm sure it's even more difficult with Trump, and we, with the anger toward police in this country, they are one force that's done a tremendous service, and that is continuing to do so in an election season when I wouldn't want to be in that job.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. The stakes are incredibly high. So I'm going to ask you a direct question. Do you think Donald Trump is a racist?
Yes, I do.
Tell me what you base that on.
I want to be careful and precise because one, I don't know if Donald Trump harbors a belief that one race is inferior to another. In fact, if I had to bet on the matter, I would probably say he doesn't harbor that belief. I think that what Trump does is deliberately stoke the ethnic tensions of his supporters. Maybe racist isn't the right word to use as shorthand, but I think that he targets and calls out particular ethnicities, people from particular countries of origin, in one case, a religion, and he deliberately stokes the bigotry that he knows exists. They talk about dog whistles a lot in American politics, and sometimes I agree with people who say, oh, that's a dog whistle. Sometimes I think, well, is that really? I'm not sure in this case. With Trump, it's just a whistle. He's this latest attack on the judge who's hearing the fraud case with Trump University, he basically said, well, he's a Mexican, therefore he's biased. His comment at the beginning of the campaign, it was something to the effect of all these rapists coming across the Mexican border, and I assume there's some good people too. as if like, well, most of them are terrible criminals, and maybe, you know, probably there's must be a few good in any bunch, right? And so I think whatever whatever revulsion we have against treating people as against judging people based on the background they come from is absolutely legitimately applied to Trump. It's interesting to me that some of his supporters, who I think would be horrified if he were to get up on and, you know, use a racial slur, say, they email me and they say, you know, I think the whole Trump racist thing is kind of overblown. And to me, I think it is part of the larger PC phenomenon that the word and the stigma associated with racism and bigotry has been thrown around so much over the years, and that it's lost some of its ability to there's a tension on college campuses that you've probably seen, where on one hand, a racist is the worst thing you can be called. If you want to be socially stigmatized on a college campus, there's nothing worse than your fellow classmates or your students or whatever the case thinking of you as a racist. On the other hand, you'll read the literature in the social justice community, the ideology in the social justice community, and they want to make the argument, well, everybody's racist, and it's time that people just acknowledged this and admitted it and faced up to their racism, faced up to the fact that they are beneficiaries of white supremacy, they're complicit in white supremacy. And I understand what the most well-intentioned people are trying to do. There's some truth to the idea that humans as a species are creatures that are tribal, that have a tendency toward picking out groups, a tendency that racism is embedded in Americans. You know, I agree with all of these underlying points, and I think that they're important to acknowledge. But there's this tension going on here where you just need more words. You need, if you're going to have one thing that's the worst thing, you can lose your job over it, you can be expelled, you could, you know. And on the other hand, it's this thing, well, we're going to have the same word and we're going to tell people that they have to acknowledge that they're that thing. And then we're going to have the same word and also label everything from the smallest microaggression to the most virulent hate crime. And we're going to use the same word for that too. Like, I just think that for a lot of Trump supporters who don't pay that much attention to politics, they've just gotten used to the racism charge being thrown around, and they don't appreciate that the way that Trump has talked about race is qualitatively different from the way that any other Republican nominee has talked about it in a long time. You go and, you know, Mitt Romney was called a racist. George W. Bush was called a racist. There are people with Hitler signs, right, when Bush was running. These guys said their language was inclusive. It was they did their best to tamp down racial bigotry in the vast majority of their public pronouncements. The way that Bush came out after 9/11, and for all his faults, the best thing he did was distinguish between, look, there are all of these Muslim Americans. We're not going to war with them. They are not the enemy. The enemy is Al-Qaeda. The enemy is bin Laden. I don't think that Trump in office at that time would have done that same thing.
Yeah, probably not, given the way he's behaved during the campaign so far. But what I want to ask is, given the the credit, I should say the lack of credit, that a Mitt Romney or a George W. Bush got for their relatively restrained and decent handling of these issues, even where a lot of people disagreed with them. They were not bigoted in their, you know, way in which they presented themselves, and they got their heads handed to them nonetheless in a certain section of the electorate. Why wouldn't a Donald Trump say, to hell with the expressive niceties, the Eugene Robinsons at the Washington Post and the Charles Blows at the New York Times, and, you know, I don't just mean to pick on the black guys. I mean, other liberal writers in other venues are still going to savage me. They're still going to show up with Nazi signs, the protesters at my rallies. I get nothing for my concession to rhetorical restraint. No benefit, because you people don't play fair. This is not really about me. It's not about what I am. It's about power and politics, and you're trying to caricature or, you know, paint me in a unflattering light, no matter what. Therefore, I tell you what I'm going to do. Discounting your support, which I'm never going to get anyway, I'm going to flaunt my willingness to cross over your lines of nicety. Call me a racist if you will. Here, let me tell you what I'm talking about. America needs to have a secure border. That's what I'm talking about. Did some Latinos get mad at me for saying so? Tough. And yeah. I don't know that that makes you a racist. This is where I'm going with all of this. I mean, for me, I understand it makes you in flagrant violation of a set of norms about public expression that have helped to keep civility intact. But I don't know that that makes you a racist. And maybe I should define racist as a hateful, again, hateful attitude or conviction of the inferiority as distinct from a willingness to step outside of, to use the N-word, to say nigger. Suppose someone went on, you know, a comedian could go on stage, a Bill Maher or something like that, and just try to provoke by using that word. Now you're going to call me a racist because I use the word. No, I'm not a racist. I'm just somebody who's not governed by your little rules that you insist upon, but that I stand outside of. I'm not moved by your rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a given definition of racist, that's absolutely right. Although I would add that to me, what Trump is doing, it's a point I've made before about Rush Limbaugh. He had this one rant I remember writing about where there was a white kid that got beat up on a middle school bus somewhere in America. And there must be people who get beat up on middle school buses somewhere in America every day. But this happened to be a white kid that got beat up by black kids in his middle school class. And it was like, it wasn't even, this kid didn't get sent to the hospital. He had a black eye or something. But it was, you know, a little story in a little local newspaper somewhere that Rush Limbaugh's researcher dug out and went on this big rant about, this was shortly after Obama was elected. Oh, in Obama's America, it's okay for black kids to beat up white kids on school buses, right? Does Rush Limbaugh believe this? No. Does he bear racial animus in his heart? No, I don't think it's evidence of that, actually. But to me, it's worse. It's stoking that kind of attention, knowing. Yeah, it's incitement, and it's you know, I would almost have more respect in this case for the guy who actually was raised with bigoted views and just had racist beliefs than the hatefulness of trying to incite this in other people, knowing it's false. It's like, I don't know. It seems worse to me. And I think, yeah, I don't know. But going back to what you were saying about Trump, and the way that he stepped outside the norms of what politicians usually do and recognizing the way that, you know, recognizing that if the people on the op-ed pages are angry at you for it, it's not going to make any difference and that you're going to get called these names anyway because that's what happens to Republican nominees. I think it's I think it's correct. And it's he's exploited it very effectively. We don't know whether how effective it will be. Maybe he'll lose in a landslide and we'll see that these norms really do retain their power. But the idea that they won't retain their power is part of what's attractive to Trump about guys like my correspondent who don't even want to go nearly as far as him, but feel like if he's going that far, it gives them license to say things that they don't even feel are bigoted at all. And, It's to me, it's reason for everyone who values some of the things that come under the rubric of political correctness, who want to defend it in some way and say, well, look, we should have these norms and stigma against calling people racial slurs. And I agree with that. But I want to press everyone on the kind of left side of the spectrum here. Maybe left and right is the wrong term even. But to look at everything that comes under the rubric of political correctness and see that there's value in teasing out, well, what do we really want to stand behind? What can we substantively defend? And what's an excess that has this negative consequence of driving what I called in my piece this kind of zero-sum thinking on the part of my 22-year-old correspondent? Because to me, there's no need for anti-racism to be a zero-sum project. To me, done correctly, it is inherently a project that is going to benefit just about everyone. Everyone except the actual white supremacists and racists who have a very different view of what the future of the country should be. But for the broad majority of Americans, there's no reason that a lot of the rhetoric around anti-racism needs to pit people against each other in the way that I think it does. And it's a frustration I have on college campuses, especially, but off them as well, that, look, if there's a way of if there's a way of pursuing good X that doesn't require us to pit people against each other to have these zero-sum transactions, well, then, like, why don't we do that? It's something that I have always thought about affirmative action in colleges. Is I absolutely understand the impulse behind it. When I look at the politics of race-based affirmative action versus class-based affirmative action, whatever you think of the merits of race-based affirmative action, right? Whatever you think about that on the merits, if you can have class-based affirmative action and know that because of the racial class disparities in America, you're going to end up taking care of all of the historically disadvantaged groups and the members of those groups who have been most hurt by institutionalized racism by going the class-based route, if you're going to get to help all of the same people and you're also going to do it in a way that changes the racial politics, isn't that worth thinking? Isn't that wouldn't that be a good thing? You had suggested at one point that the one of the arguments against affirmative action is that it stigmatizes the black students that end up on campus. And you had made an argument, I think, in a Blogging Heads with John McCorder, that if you threw some working class white kids into the mix, whatever you think about the merits of that, it would also change the politics on campus, because then it wouldn't just be black kids walking around campus with that stigma insofar as that exists, right?
Right.
To me, these questions are all worth thinking about, not just on the substantive merits of, you could have a purely narrow conversation, is race-based affirmative action prudent or not, justified or not, whatever. But to me, it's important to bring a realistic assessment of how the country is going to react to it. And I look ahead and I see these lawsuits with the Asian American community divided about whether they think affirmative action is a good thing, whether they think college admissions should be pure merit-based. And it's just another example that I see coming in this increasingly diverse and pluralistic society, where it's not going to be white-black anymore. That's not going to be the racial dialogue of the future of America. And do we want to set up a system that is, I don't know if zero-sum is the right word, but where different racial groups are competing for their share of college admissions or whatever?
Well, we have – that's the system that we have, and we've had it for some time. And I just want to say, I think the class versus race affirmative action question is complicated. Going to a class-based framework would have the benefits that you described, but it would also dramatically affect the composition of those African-American students who were benefited by affirmative action. And you could argue that that might not be the best thing. What I'm trying to say is some of the most talented African-American students happen also not to be poor, but may not be as competitive as some of the best of the Asian and white students applying and therefore benefit from affirmative action. And you kind of want that to be the case if you were trying to, you know. But I want to say one more thing, and I think maybe we should call it a day because we're getting to 1 hour mark here. And that is that there's a sociologist named John David Scrittney. He's at the University of California, San Diego. He's a very interesting guy. He's written a book called The Ironies of Affirmative Action. He's written another book called The Minority Rights Revolution. And one of the concepts that he has in the Minority Rights Revolution, which is a history of how the various administrative categories of minorities, you know, Latino, Hispanic, Asian, Pacific Islander, et cetera, came into being, and the lobbying that went on in the 1960s and 70s to get that framework laid down, he calls it the Black analogy. He says that if a group is able effectively to make an analogy between its circumstance and its claims on the one hand and the historical experience of African Americans on the other, then they have a leg up on getting recognized and respected by the power structure. The Black analogy. And of course, in the debate about marriage equality for gays and lesbians, the Black analogy was a very, you know, Loving versus Virginia. You know, we know that they used to prohibit interracial marriage. This is a similar thing. In the debate about the bathrooms in North Carolina and, you know, gender identity and the transsexuals and so on, again, a kind of analogy of it's bigotry if you don't recognize that the latter day view about gender identity and the respect for it, the fluidity of gender identity and so forth. If you are still going around thinking that an X and a Y chromosome makes you male and two X chromosomes makes you female, then you're a bigot. And what strikes me about that, that I think is actually problematic, is that these analogies are not perfect. And at some level, when things are changing, a tolerance of the fact that not everybody is on the same page that we progressives are on right at this moment would seem to me to be a virtue. I hesitate here because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not really taking a substantive position against gays marrying or against transsexual people choosing the bathroom that they go into, though I don't think those cases are themselves exactly the same. But I don't think that the state of North Carolina that might have a heavily Christian electorate that might be somewhat more socially conservative than San Francisco or New York City or something like that is filled with bigots because they are not yet in tune with the latter day understanding about how do we decide who gets to go into what bathroom. And this language of bigotry, this language of hatred, imputing to people the kinds of motives that we associate with segregationists and so on, this effort indirectly through the language to invoke the Black analogy and therefore to get a kind of moral trump card that you can flap down on the table. You see there, if you don't agree with me, you're a bigot, you're hateful. I think that's part of what fuels this backlash. I know that if I were on the other side of that language, if I were a prayerful, Bible-believing, reasonable person, but simply not yet attuned to the latter-day sensibility, I would be profoundly offended to be told that because I don't agree with you about the bathrooms, I'm hateful, I'm a bigot, I'm someone who should be viewed with contempt.
Yeah, I was when the Department of Education put out its guidelines on transgender students, I was asking questions on Twitter, like trying to understand what exactly the guidelines were. And one of the questions I was asking is, if you're a principal, if you're a high school principal, do you have any recourse if the four guys you've known as pranksters on the high school football team for all 4 years of their career. If one of them dares the other one to go and shower in the girls' locker room, does the principal have discretion to say, no, I don't believe that you're transgender? Do they have to take the word of students, right? Because if you let them have that discretion, they're going to abuse it. It's a country of 300 million people. Some high school boy is going to do this. How does that situation play out? And I quickly saw my mentions fill up with people who were stigmatizing me for asking the question. It struck me that, on the spectrum of LGBT rights, you're not going to get much further. You're not going to get much further left than a libertarian who was, arguing for gay marriage long before most of the country. The degree of people that these people are applying, if you're going to stigmatize anyone at my position or right on this issue, right, you're not just stigmatizing. It fits really weird. It fits really weirdly with the rest of leftist politics, by which I mean, this is a position held, the far left transgender position, right, is held. If you look at the polling, it's like a upper middle class position. These are the enclaves where it is held and believed. If you want to go to the center of where people, you'd go to like Berkeley, you'd go to like Santa Monica, right? You'd go to parts of New York City. You wouldn't go to the poor parts of New York City, right? If you look in the world, right, America is far to the left of the whole. So are we going to stigmatize? Is the vast majority of everyone in the whole continents of Asia and Africa, because they have to fall under this stigma. If everyone who believes this is bigots who ought to be like outside polite society, right? It's just nonsense. All of South America, right? Like, you couldn't find a majority. You couldn't find a country in South America where a majority of people think that transgender students should shower in whatever they identify by, right? It's just like, this isn't a policy that exists in very many places in the world. Maybe you could find it in a little bit of Northern Europe, right? It just fits very uneasily with the idea that the United States shouldn't take a culturally imperialist mindset, that it shouldn't, that the perspectives of poor people should be listened to, right? Like, there's just no way to square these two different things. There's no way to square all of these people are bigots and we ought to treat these large groups of people that we always think we should otherwise treat with respect. And I just don't get it. It seems like it can't be that people really think that everyone who is right of them on this issue, they can't really believe all those people are bigots. It must just be, I don't know. It must just be something that they haven't thought through, I think.
I think that's right. And I'm going to let that be the last word here, Connor. Thanks a lot for your time today. So we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.